Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening. We're broadcasting this week live from the State Capitol in Pierre, and now Governor Dennis Dugard is sitting down with us. His State of the State address was yesterday. Welcome, Governor Dugard.
Thank you, Lori. Good to be with you.
It's nice to meet you. Let's start out with education. A lot of the response from teachers is that they feel validated, they feel heard by your speech. Some have some tweaks here and there that they'd like, but overall it's been a response. Do you feel like they weren't heard before? Where do you think that great validation is coming from them?
Well, certainly this is a very large increase in dollars that's being proposed for teacher salaries. And I think the Blue Ribbon Task Force did a very good job of taking anecdotal information, which sometimes is validated by the data and sometimes is not. And they looked at the data and studied it and debunked some myths about education funding. And one of the anecdotes that they validated was the gap in teacher pay and the fact that it really could not be met without significant additional dollars into the formula. At the same time, they recognize that the school funding formula in some ways is inequitable and maybe could be a little more efficient. And so they recommended a very good approach to doing both, helping provide the dollars necessary so that teachers will be compensated in a competitive way, and at the same time encouraging school districts, and in some cases mandating school districts, toward more equity and more efficiency.
So one of the things I keep wanting to say in this conversation as a parent is we talk about being last, but we're talking about being last in teacher pay, certainly not last in quality.
No.
Although, you know, hiring is an issue you mentioned competitively, but I always think of the wonderful teachers that my daughter has. So it's not for lack of quality of applicants. It's just that being competitive is what you're talking about.
We do have good quality education in South Dakota, no question about it. The concern, I think, is being sure that we don't lose that. Because one of the things the task force identified was there are an adequate number of teachers being produced by our education system or moving to South Dakota or who may have a partial ability to get credentials, which can be added to and give a person credentials to be a teacher. And that those three avenues would provide enough teachers to fill the projected need, but just barely. And the problem with meeting the need just barely is that some of those teachers won't be in the right disciplines. We might not have enough math teachers or enough science teachers or enough Spanish teachers, and I'm just using those by way of example, but we won't have the right disciplines, or we'll have the right disciplines in the wrong places. We'll have teachers who have a spouse working in one city and the opening is in another city, and so they can't take the job in the other city. Or if you have a one-to-one ratio, then the school districts can't be selective, and they're, when they've got a very small pool of candidates, they can't aim for the highest quality candidates because they simply have to take what's available. And then because we're a rural state, it's always going to be hard for our rural school districts to attract folks out to the more remote areas, and they can't have a disadvantage in salary added to that difficulty in recruiting to the rural areas.
So the proposal itself is not necessarily a slam dunk. There's lots of work ahead to happen. One of the questions we got from Facebook is if there is resistance to the sales tax increase, what alternatives are in development to raise that salary in a different way?
Well, it'd be very difficult to raise it in a different way without new money. We looked at that, certainly. I'm not a fan of increased taxes, and we did look at that. If we want to address this problem immediately, it will definitely take more money. And the sales tax is probably the most straightforward way to do that. I think it has support from most voters. It would be my judgment. We'd also get some out-of-state help during the tourist season to pay for that, because those visitors pay a lot of sales tax, so we'll collect a little bit from other states.
Well, we can't deny that the monthly budget for lots of people, some of many of whom don't make as much as the average teacher does, is about to go up. So for poorer communities or poor families, now milk, everything is, you know, clothing, everything becomes more expensive for them. What's your response to that? Because that's a real issue too, don't you think?
Well, we still have probably the lowest, if maybe the 49th lowest tax burden in the nation. And if you look at the fact that we don't have an income tax, those low-income families, maybe they wouldn't pay an income tax, but we still have among states that have no income tax, we have among the lowest sales taxes as well. And so it's not as if we are adding to an unfair burden already. I think the burden is quite low today. And I think it sounds appealing to, say, remove the sales tax on food. But the fact of the matter is most people who pay sales tax on food are perfectly capable of paying it, perfectly capable. And to say that someone like me shouldn't pay sales tax on food is not using a surgery knife. They're using a blunt instrument to attack the problem of the very low income having to pay sales tax on food. And we have to remember that the very low income get food stamps to help them. And it's a better, more targeted approach to look at those solutions through something like a food stamps program, rather than saying just across the board, nobody pays sales taxes on food. The other point about that is it is a sales tax on essentials like that that keep our revenue stream from being too volatile as the economy roller coasters. So when income tax states or states that maybe tax luxuries, when the economy goes into recession, their revenues drop precipitously. Our revenues, because our sales tax is very broad and low, it does not drop as significantly as it would otherwise if we had it on only non-essentials.
Sure. I want to jump subjects real quick because there's other things to talk about.
Sure.
One of the things you mentioned is in corrections, and we talked about safety of South Dakota crime rates being down. I interviewed Sheriff Mike Milstead of Minnehaha County a couple weeks ago, and the violent crimes or the felonies in Sioux Falls are up out of proportion with their population. They're looking at building a new jail in spite of having more people outside the jail, you know, with their criminal justice reforms and the drug courts and things like that. So my question for you is there's still a need for new jails and places like the Star Academy in Custer. Do those places still need to exist even as criminal justice reform sort of evolves?
Oh, no question. We are always going to need prisons and jails to lock up violent offenders. And I hope your listeners are aware that the criminal justice reforms that have been passed, both on the adult system and the juvenile system, did nothing to remove jail or prison sanctions from violent people. They only dealt with the nonviolent offenders, people who are using drugs or alcohol or petty theft and things like that, where they commit those kind of nonviolent crimes, they might be placed on probation, they violate the terms of the probation, and then suddenly they're in prison for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're dealing with someone with a substance addiction, of course you're not going to maintain that addiction while you're in prison, but nor are you going to deal with the self-discipline issues that you're going to have to confront when you're released. And evidence-based practices in other states have demonstrated that it's more effective to take someone with a substance abuse addiction and treat them in their community so they learn through their own self-discipline to say, no, Dennis, I can't go to the bar. I'm 2 days away from earning 30 days off my probation sentence through perfect compliance, and I'm not going to screw that up. So while I'm in the environment where the Dennises of the world are tempting me to go out to the bar or use drugs, if I have instead the treatment and counseling to help me overcome that temptation and resist it, then it's much more likely to be sustainable than if you give them some substance treatment and abuse treatment in prison when they really can't have access to it anyway. You don't need any self-discipline in prison because you just don't have access.
Mm. Right. Let's go to another comment from Facebook, and this was from a Sioux Falls native who had moved to Florida and was hearing things about the scandals from this year, and you talked a lot about transparency and open government going forward. So are you concerned that, and she was wondering, why am I hearing about this as far away from Florida as what's going on in South Dakota? Are you concerned that state residents are losing their trust in government, and how do you reestablish that at this point?
If our residents are losing trust in state government is from a misperception, because I believe that the vast majority of state employees and other government employees are trustworthy and honest and hardworking. In every walk of life, there will be a very small number of people, whether they're in the private sector or in the public sector, who violate that trust, who let greed take over, and think they can get away with something, and then do get away with something for a while, and then get caught. And every time, what we need to do is examine these instances every time they occur and say, how can we be better? How can we avoid this from recurring?
And how can we? What are you? You mentioned some things in the state of the state. Maybe you could be more specific about those here again as a reminder. What are some of the things going forward that we should watch for, that we're going to recognize as citizens? And okay, that's an attempt to make sure that we know it's open, it's transparent.
Yeah. Well, let's examine Mid-Central Co-op. Mid-Central Co-op is a quasi-government organization. It is governed by a board of directors that is made up of school board members drawn from the districts who are members. So if I'm the school board member from Del Rapids, and Del Rapids isn't a member of Mid-Central, but if I'm on the school board for Del Rapids, I might be assigned, okay, you're one of the board members for the Mid-Central Co-op. Well, and then as that board of directors, just like any nonprofit or any for-profit board, you hire the CEO, and then that CEO hires the staff. And like any nonprofit CEO, they check the box on their Form 990 with the IRS saying, we have conflict of interest provisions and we are abiding by them. Well, they may have conflict of interest provisions for governing their school, and they may have them for Mid-Central, but they clearly weren't following them. So what I think that tells us in the state government is if we contract with someone, even though they're a government, another government or a quasi-government, we can't depend upon them. However public-spirited those board members may be, they've got their hands full with their own school district probably. And to be sure that the members of Mid-Central Co-op were watching their own conflict of interest provisions, maybe it's beyond them. Well, then maybe we have to do it for them. Maybe we have to go in there and every so often conduct an internal controls audit and check to be sure. When I was at Children's Home Society, the CEO there, every one of our board members every year had to read the conflict of interest provision policy and sign it to say that they had read it, so they understood it. And we had some board members that when they realized, oh, I want to sell an insurance policy to this organization and I can't do that under the policy, they resigned the board. And that's fine, but then there's arm's length between the organization and the person with whom the organization is doing business. In Mid-Central, and I'm just speaking from what has been revealed in the press, apparently some of the members of Mid-Central, Scott Westerhaus, the man who killed his family and himself, created these outside entities, and that he benefited not only as an employee of Mid-Central, but he hired himself. Well, that's ridiculous. That's a conflict of interest, and we need to do a better job of making sure as a state that we're not only supervising our own employees, but we're looking into the practices of those people with whom we do business.
Has that been frustrating for you?
Very frustrating. And at the outset, Melody Schaap, who did the right thing by terminating the contract, there was nothing in the audits that suggested criminal action or conflict of interest, but they were just not attentive to good accounting practices. They wouldn't do the wrap-up work at the end of a fiscal year, you know, apply your accrued or accumulated depreciation against an asset and show the net. They weren't doing just simple, very wrap-up things, and they were criticized by their auditors for not having adequate internal controls. Well, that's not unusual in small organizations. It doesn't necessarily mean there's wrongdoing going on. It just means they have so few employees that there's more opportunity for impropriety. And in fact, they got rid of that in their last audit. So they did improve that area. But there are so many other areas. Melody essentially terminated the contract as a consequence of their poor accounting practices and their failure to document well every time. We had to hold their hand all the time. My guess is, and again, it's just a guess, and Scott Westerhus saw the House of Cards about to come tumbling down. And not only would he lose all the income from not only would the organization lose the income, but he'd lose all these contracts that he apparently had side organizations to benefit from.
Sure. So getting to know that whole story, I get the sense that you're feeling like a lot of us are, that, you know, boy, I sure would like to know that whole story, but we'll never necessarily know everything, but we're waiting for.
Yeah,
for
we should know. We should, ultimately, the people who are being investigated and the financial records of those people, they should come to light. And hopefully they'll be, if there's criminal wrongdoing that was undertaken by Scott Westerhus, well, obviously it's too late to charge him. But there's no reason not for that information not to become public.
Sure.
I mean, he's not as if he's going to be slandered. He's not with us any longer.
So at the beginning of your tenure, you had to make some tough budget cuts. You've gone through this conversation even here today, which is still frustrating. But now we're talking about places like Spearfish Canyon and New State Park. Is that a lot more fun? Are you having more fun now?
Yeah, it is definitely more fun.
Tell me about that project, because when you went over that yesterday, that was exciting to me personally, and I think to a lot of South Dakotans. So give us a heads up of what's coming.
Well, I would say 2 years ago, when we were looking at Good Earth State Park and improving the visitor center at Custer State Park, I will say that the idea of a Spearfish Canyon State Park was raised at that time, but it wasn't ripe. Number one, we were already biting off a lot with Good Earth State Park, and we were investing some money in Custer State Park. And starting a new state park always does take more money, and it takes time and it takes effort. Moreover, we had two parcels of land in Spearfish Canyon that we'd acquired from Homestake that the state owned, but there was a larger bridging piece that we did not own. So they were two separate pieces, and it's hard to have a state park that's located in two places,
right,
without the two being joined. Well, we've been working, and I have to give credit to the Spearfish Canyon Foundation, this group of concerned owners and lovers of Spearfish Canyon. They were very persistent in working with Homestake, and I've chipped in a little bit in terms of encouragement to Barrick, that owns this property, that we'd like to take that on, and then we'd pay for that, and Spearfish Canyon would reimburse us or give us the dollars to pay for it. Now we're just a couple weeks away from making that happen. So suddenly now we do, and we could foresee a few months ago that we would have a contiguous piece of land that includes Spearfish Falls, Rough Lock Falls, Little Spearfish Creek, Spearfish Creek, and a beautiful, beautiful piece of the canyon. And we also had an area that a number of years ago was recognized. This area should be preserved against any grazing by livestock. Mm. So it's been in the areas where it must be fenced off. It is. In some areas, the terrain is so steep that no fencing's needed. But there is an area that has been surveyed and fenced. And so it was a natural to look at that area, because it also surrounds the property that the state owns on the creek itself. Within that area, there have been some improvements by the National Forest Service, but not a lot. The roads are a little bit rough, and the facilities are pretty primitive. And many people who would visit the canyon are completely unaware that some of the iconic places are there. So this will, hopefully, if we can get this swap worked out with the National Forest Service, and we don't have it yet, so this is not a done deal.
How long does something like this take? What are we watching for?
Well, we're hoping for legislation sometime in 2016. And Senator Thune is optimistic. We've been working here in the last couple of months since we spoke with Senator Thune in October about this, to find comparable pieces of property that would be attractive that the state owns. So, for example, we might have a parcel that is surrounded by Bureau of Land Management property, and the state has an inholding that's an island within their surrounding property. Well, they would like that to clean up their land. And so we've been finding islands like that, or contiguous pieces that have BLM or National Forest on two sides. So we're trying to find an acre-for-acre swap about the same quality of land. And if we can get that done, and I think we're very close to that, then Senator Thune would put it into a bill, and I think the Congress wouldn't care.
State parks are personal to you.
Yes.
As well as something that's personal to a lot of residents, it's important to you personally. How come?
Well, I think the state has some state parks, and they are truly the resort to which people who don't have lots of land, who live in the city, who want to have a nature experience, they can resort to the state park. And it's not like the National Forest where they can hike in and hike out, or they really don't know what's there or where to go and where the pretty sites are. The state parks are designed to find those and develop camping, develop trails, and preserve them and take care of them and improve them. And so this park, if we're able to put it together, should be our second largest park behind only Custer State Park. Custer State Park is the behemoth, 70-some thousand acres, and this would be something over 1,000 acres, maybe nearly 1,500 acres.
So this is a big part of preserving our natural spaces in South Dakota. Do we have, when we start talking about some of the flooding we're seeing East River, or some of the other issues that may indicate some climate change, do we have a plan in the state to be part of that climate change conversation in a way that makes sense for South Dakota? I know like Minnesota has a plan. Is that something that's on the radar?
My son Chris and I were canoeing the Big Sioux. We take a canoe trip every summer, and we normally canoe the Missouri River just because it's more dramatic and cleaner. And then this year I was down in the Sioux Falls area on the Thursday night before our Friday, Saturday, Sunday trip, and we were going to take off, and then this huge rainfall came to Sioux Falls, and I said to Chris, let's canoe the Sioux River because it's going to be roaring. And so we took that trip, and there are beautiful parts down that Sioux River that I would like to preserve somehow. I'm hopeful we can preserve somehow.
Governor Dennis Dugard, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I'd like to thank our guests for today, the governor, also Dana Ferguson, Seth Tupper, Keely Boltina from SDPB. We had Charles Michael Ray, Steve Munson, Steve Zwemke, Chris Luffy, Gina Myrose. Tomorrow on midday, we've got Chief Justice David Gilbertson, Speaker of the House, Dean Wink, Senator Billy Sutton, Representatives Kevin Killer and Sean Bardot. We'll see you tomorrow. You're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.